and welcome again to another edition of Lost in Science across Australia on the Community Radio Network. This is half an hour or thereabouts where we will be talking about science. Well, I am Stu, and on the show with me this week I have Claire.
Hello, Stu.
Hi, Claire. How are you going?
Yeah, I'm good, thank you. I'm very, very well. And even better this week because we have a special guest on the show, Professor at RMIT University, Dr. Oliver Jones, is on Lost in Science this week. And the reason Oliver is talking to us this week is because, you know, there's a lot of environmental pollutants out there. And I know this is something that we have talked about on the show quite a lot, you know, your PFAS and your microplastics and whatnot. Dr. Oliver is an environmental scientist and chemist, and he is just going to talk us through sort of like the risks of some of these environmental pollutants and, you know, why it is maybe that you see the headlines and you see, you know, some stories and social media and whatnot that talk about the dangers of some of these environmental pollutants, but what the actual sort of like risks associated with them are and what the research says. So we're going to have a bit of a chat about, about some of those environmental pollutants and what they are and why they're bad or, you know, why they're maybe not as, in certain concentrations, not as bad as they have been made out to be.
Yeah, it's always interesting when you're talking about, you know, toxicology and that sort of thing, how we talk about hazard and we talk about risk, but a lot of people don't see the difference between the two.
Yeah.
Something can be very, very dangerous, but in the exposure levels you get in day-to-day life, it's not a real risk. So, you know.
That's right. Yeah.
I think and a lot of journalists love a bit of fear-mongering too, so it doesn't help.
Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting, as Ollie will talk about, one of the biggest pollutants is air pollution, and that doesn't, you know, that seems to affect health more than any other type of pollution that we know of, and it just doesn't seem to get the same sort of coverage that some of these other pollutants get. That's not to say any pollution is good pollution or that we shouldn't be worried about it, but just thinking about it in terms of, yeah, like you say, what are the actual hazards and what is the actual risk? So yeah. Stay tuned for that. And how about you, Stu? What are you going to be talking to us about this week?
Well, I'm going to be talking about stamp collecting.
Oh. Hang on, checks notes. Is this Lost in Science or lost in your nerdy collections from your childhood?
I'm not really talking about philately. I'm actually
philately, that's what it's called, is it?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Didn't know that the guy from Riverdance was a stamp
collector. Oh gosh.
Michael Philately. No, I'm talking about taxonomy, which some scientists kind of look on taxonomy as stamp collecting. It's just, oh, you're just finding things and naming them. But it is a really important part of, certainly of the biological sciences. We need to agree that we're talking about the same things when we're studying things. So, you know, it's kind of a pretty important base level that we all need to have when we're studying
totally.
The natural world.
Yeah.
And, you know,
yep.
And we rely on the natural world. But I'm also.
And if you can find me a better way to, you know, be able to name a beetle after yourself, then I'm all ears. But taxonomy seems to be the surefire way to get an animal named after you, right?
Well, I mean, and particularly you chose beetles very wisely. There's more beetles
right.
than just about everything else. So if you want something named after you, it's probably going to be a beetle. Or potentially a fungus or an algae or something something sexy like that. But I'm just going to be talking about a little bit about how things are named, why they're named the way they're named, and also some changes that have happened in naming. And there's a few little movements around to sort of rethink the way we name things, which can change things in ways that are not really going to affect most people, but will make some people's lives a little bit easier. So I'll get onto that a bit later and what I'm actually talking about a bit later in the show. So please stay tuned. In the life sciences, as I mentioned earlier, the naming of various things, various species, is known as taxonomy. And it's a very important part of the process of studying living things and has been for a long time. So anyone studying zoology or botany would be familiar with the binomial classification of species. And this is where we put things into a genus based on that it's related to other things in that genus, and then we give it a specific name to separate out the species in the genus. So there's obviously higher classifications, and I know you've done a bit of bio in your life, Claire, and you would be aware of the families and the orders and the kingdoms and all of the other
layers. And I still can't remember the mnemonic. So don't ask me.
Well, I'm not going to go there because honestly, binomial is good enough. If you can pull out the genus and the species of something, you can figure the other stuff out later. If you can identify something by genus and species, you're doing really well. So
yeah,
you know, it's probably the most useful one. It's the most day-to-day distinction.
It's the most specific one, right?
It is literally the most specific. I mean, you've got to be careful though, because in both zoology and in botany, there are classifications below species, but we're not gonna mess around in that subspecies variety.
We're not getting into the weeds on that.
No. It's just way too complicated once you get down there. But look, The whole point is that if you're working on a particular species, you want to know that you're reading articles, you're reading journal papers, you're reading things that are based on the same species. So we need to know it's the same name.
Mm.
So you probably know this was all proposed by a Swedish guy called Carl von Linn, who thought it was such a good idea. He started calling himself Carolus Linnaeus. He went full Latin on us.
Wow. Yeah.
Wow.
I mean, live by, like...
Example, yeah.
Live by example.
Yeah, although...
Linnaeus lives by example.
He did kind of get it backwards, though, because he should have been Linnaeus Carolus if he was going to use it properly. But, hey, he's long gone, so we won't hassle him too much. But look, the reason he came up with this system, because before this, the names of plants and animals were basically a sentence in Latin that described the animal, and they could go on and on and on, getting more and more detailed. And, you know, there's only a certain number of species. So, you know, Linnaeus sort of went, hey, why don't we just say, you know, it's a genus and a species, and we'll just stick with that. And every species gets its own species name, and that seems to be working pretty well so far. So, made it much easier for taking notes. You know, if you're learning stuff, you can take notes quicker, and there's ways of abbreviating it. You can put the genus, just put the first letter of the genus and then the species name if you keep repeating it throughout a paper or something like that. And you could obviously compare notes more easily because you don't have to read these whole big long sentences. You can just go, oh, it's this species. Yep, it's this species. Genus species, done. Now, it also kind of brought about the need for a centralized body to record and arbitrate on the names of things so that we were sure that everybody was using the same names. And all of this obviously arose in Europe. It's based on Latin being a European language. And they also came up, as you said, Claire, that if you want a beetle named after you, this is the way to do it. People using this system, if you name something, if you found something new and you named it, you got the rights to name it whatever you liked. And people have done that since this system sort of came into being. And everyone, you know, you present it to this centralized body and everyone has to use that name from that point because you're the winner and you found it first. Or you named it first.
Really, you named it first,
People have, you know, known about most things all over the place for a really long time before they even had names.
Or you named it in this system first.
Well, that's right. And a lot of this early on was in Latin. And partly because there was a huge number of plants in Europe that were known by their Latin names because the Romans already knew them and they called them something in Latin because that's what they spoke. So we ended up with this Latin, you know, people still call, oh, what's the Latin name of something? And that's referring back to this, is that often things did have Latin names. But as, you know, as European explorers spread out, they brought the system with them, and a lot of it's not Latin. It's not, you know, and even within Europe, a lot of it's from ancient Greek and all sorts of different things as well. So saying what's the Latin name, that's why I try and use the term binomial name, because that covers everything. So as I said, not everything had a Latin name, and the Europeans spread out through the world finding new species and collecting them and classifying them under this system, and they would offering incorporate existing Latin genus names. So, you know, there's species that are in Europe that are in a particular genus. They'd go to, say, Africa and find new species, but they're in the same genus. They're obviously in the same genus. They go, oh, we'll just chuck it in that genus we've already got. We'll give it a new species name. And then obviously they also had to make up new genera as they got to different places and went, wow, we've never seen anything like this before. What the heck is going on? Now, in some cases, they, because, you know, they didn't have a Latin name for it. They had the Latin genus name, potentially. They didn't have a Latin name because the Romans didn't know these plants, so why would they have a word for it? So they would, in some cases, add a species name that was related to, you know, a local term for the plant. You know, what do the local people call this plant? They'll chuck that in as the species name, or a word that was commonly used in relation to the plant. And you know, often they would try and use, you know, sometimes try and use a Latin word that would describe something, you know, a colour or something like that.
Something about rubra. It. Right.
Rubra is a common one, meaning it's red. Or, you know, xantho means yellow, so, or golden. So that's often found in plant names. But there's been a bit of a concern recently that often plants get named for people. And one of the reasons people are sort of furrowing their brows about this is that it's not necessarily an equitable way to go about naming plants or animals. So, for example, the genus Banksia, we all know what a Banksia, the big flowers, big tall flowers.
Yeah, Joseph Banks.
Joseph Banks. So Joseph Banks cited flowering Banksias in 1770, and so he got the whole genus named after him. But obviously people in Sydney Cove and beyond had known about Banksias for thousands of years before Joe showed up and slapped his name on them. They just didn't use that binomial system. So people sort of going, is that, you know, he saw them for the first time. That didn't mean he actually discovered them, because there was people already using them and, you know, calling them different names already. So there's that's sort of a reasonable, I guess, concern that people have. And there's been a push among some botanists to review the use of what they call eponyms, which is naming plants after people, particularly when those people represent sort of colonial forces coming into the place where these plants originate, where people already used and knew those plants and had names for them already. We could possibly just use those names and incorporate them into the binomial system, potentially. One of the other things about Linnaeus was that he didn't have a Darwinian view of evolution. He didn't actually think about evolution. He thought everything was static. He thought all species were the same. They'd always been the same. They were never going to change. And that's why his system was so good, because you could just say, this is this species and it will always be this species.
Mm.
That, I don't know how much biology he studied. He obviously was doing his taxonomy thing, but the variation within a species is massive often. So the idea that there's no change within that species is kind of an unusual point to take. But, you know, he thought...
I mean, that's the whole idea of speciation, isn't it?
Yes, but you know, the species being specific, you know, speciation as a concept didn't come until after Darwin. So he was before Darwin. He didn't really think in that way. So he didn't think new species arose. He didn't think they went extinct, and everything in the world was in balance according to the way he viewed the world. But later understanding of evolution by natural selection after Darwin led biologists to conclude that all living things were related, and new species could arise when conditions changed. And the feeling was, the logical conclusion was that taxonomy should reflect that origin of these different species. So the genus and the species and those higher levels of classification should reflect the evolution of the species that make up the living things on the planet. And so that sort of led to people starting to reclassify things according to how closely related they were, rather than just, I found it and I called it this and we'll call it that forevermore. They started thinking in terms of, you know, the systems that brought them into being. So probably the most useful tool is quite a lot more recent than Darwin, and certainly a lot more recent than Linnaeus, is genetic analysis. So with genetic analysis, we can look very clearly at the connections between species and figure out and have a much better understanding of their relationships and their evolution. And that has led to many, 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 many name changes in taxonomy to reflect this understanding, to reflect how related plants are. And it's changed a lot of things, particularly in botany and things like that, where plants were assumed to be closely related because they looked kind of similar. And then genetic analysis has discovered, oh no, that's actually convergent evolution. They were just in similar environments, so that's why they look the same, and things like that. So, and this kind of name changing is all in the name of better scientific understanding, and even some very old names that stretch all the way back to ancient Rome have been changed. One of the first plants I ever learned when I was learning basic botany and when I was studying horticulture was rosemary, the plant rosemary.
Ah, yes.
Which was Rosmarinus officinalis, which is the Latin name for rosemary. You know, they were sticking bits of rosemary in with their roast all the way back then. It's been that for centuries and centuries. We've all called it that. It's not called that anymore. It's now Salvia rosmarinus.
Because, oh, there you go. It's part of the Salvia family.
Yeah, so it's close enough related genus to sage.
Wow.
Yeah, that they went, oh, actually, we've been calling it this separate genus. It's not a separate genus. It's just very similar, and it's got this distinctive aroma. But it's a sage in the end. So that's what the, you know.
Wow, it's been masquerading as its own thing for so long. Sorry, yeah. Rosemary, you're just a cousin of sage.
Now, beyond scientific reasons for changing plant names, there are other reasons why plant names might be changed. And recently, the International Botanical Congress voted to change the specific name for over 200 species of plants because the name is offensive, basically. It's an offensive name. So the botanical name Caffra is applied to a large number of species from the African continent. But the name Caffra itself is derived from an offensive term used by colonial Europeans for indigenous Africans.
Mm.
So this has been something that African botanists have been concerned about for a couple of decades at least, and, you know, certainly that's publicly and privately, who knows. So that name is being replaced with the specific name Afra to represent that they're from Africa, which is not really going to offend anyone. It's a geographical indicator of where the plants are from. So there are a number, I said over 200 species. There's algae, there's plants, true plants, and there's fungi with this specific name. They're all getting changed to Afra so that we won't use that term anymore. And at the same meeting, the scientists all at the meeting agreed to form a committee who could debate and discuss these sort of changes in the future, and also to accept submissions about names that should be changed for, you know, for social and cultural reasons rather than scientific reasons, which, you know, I think is a reasonable thing for plant naming, to, you know, not offend anyone unnecessarily when, you know, times have changed since, you know, 200, 300 years ago when some of these names were first applied. I think it's pretty reasonable if it's actually offending people to just change them to something else that doesn't cause any offence. It's not going to change the plant, as, you know, as Shakespeare said, a rose by any other name would smell as sweet. I think it's not the name that makes the plant, it's just the name that helps us to study them and compare notes, and, you know, all this stuff can be recorded. It's not going to really affect anyone, I think, in the long term, except in a positive way, because there's no reason for anyone to feel like they're being slurred by a plant name, I suppose. As long as the plant names are clearly defined, as long as we have a central body to record what plant names are, usefulness of this system of naming and this naming system, it won't be changed by substituting these colonial names with more culturally appropriate names in the future.
Congratulations on your discovery, which may well prove to be among the most significant in the history of science.
I cannot accept half-baked theories that sell newspapers. I'm a scientist.
Who are you? Who are so wise in the ways of science?
A most distinguished scientist whose name we know even in the wild of Transylvania.
Across Australia on the Community Radio Network, you are listening to Lost in Science.
Chemical pollution in the environment can be a very scary thing, from hormone disruptors to PFAS and other persistent chemicals, and of course microplastics. Pollution can be linked to a bunch of ill health effects. But how worried should we be? And what ways can we go about reducing our risk? Well, this week on the show, we have Professor Oliver Jones from RMIT University to talk us through some of these chemicals, some of these pollutants, and what is the actual risk as opposed to the perceived risk. Oliver, welcome to Lost in Science, or should I say welcome back to Lost in Science.
Oh, thank you very much for having me back.
Let's start off with PFAS, the forever chemicals that have been making headlines and documentaries on streaming services. They're now found all over the world and in our own bodies. What is it about these chemicals initially that make them so pervasive and so worrying for us?
Yeah, well, PFAS is a catch-all term for a bunch of chemicals called alkyl substances. And what makes them interesting is that they're characterized by carbon fluorine bonds, and that is a very strong chemical bond. It's very hard to break down, so they last a long time. They're quite persistent, and they have been implicated in some health effects in the US. That was the case in the film Dark Waters, which was based on a book called Exposure, written by an environmental lawyer called Rob Bellott, and that really sort of raised the issue of PFAS contamination and the possible health risks. But the thing is that that particular exposure scenario was people that were working in a chemical plant that was making these compounds, or they lived close to it where there had been some incorrect disposal of chemical waste from the plant. So it's not the same situation directly as most of us would come across PFAS.
Yeah, what are sort of considered unhealthy levels of these catch-all PFAS chemicals?
Well, that's a good question, actually. It depends what you're trying to protect against, shall we say. So the different environmental protection agencies have different, well, actually, they don't have different, because they collectively came up with some guidelines, which is in what's called the PFAS NEMP, which is the National Environment Monitoring Plan, I think, or management plan, sorry. And they have different levels, sort of at the nanogram per liter range, for protecting different amounts of species. So they have the 95% protection, the 99%. They actually recently walked it back a little bit, because they figured essentially if you aim for the very lowest level, it's almost impossible to meet. So it's sort of pointless having a guideline that no one can actually attain. So, and in fact, in humans, it's a little bit more up in the air. So there's no like level where you could say, well, if you're exposed to more than this, you're definitely going to have a health effect. And if you're exposed to less, then you're fine. Because it's all related to other factors. So for example, you might be ill with something else, you might have other chemical pollution, etc. But for most of us, the levels are tiny. We're talking about nanogram per liter, which is we're in the parts per billion range.
For most of us, we're exposed to tiny amounts, or for most of us, for most of us, the unhealthy range is tiny.
Yes, we're exposed to very, very low levels, almost pretty much the limit to what we can actually measure.
Right. Well, that's interesting, because I mean, I guess exposures only happened over the last little while, seeing as they've just been developed.
I think they were first created in the 1940s, and they've been in use, I think, industrially since the 1950s.
Right.
And so the major use recently has been in aqueous firefighting, or film-forming firefighting foams, which is these big sort of, well, it's just basically foam that you spray on, particularly fires that are caused by engine fuels and aviation fuels. So that's why you find hotspots of contamination at airports and defense training sites and firefighting training sites, where people have been spraying this stuff, basically practicing fighting fires.
More recent exposures or other ways that humans are exposed, in addition to the firefighting, through water repellent clothing, I've heard, is that?
Yes. So PFAS have interesting properties in that they repel both fats and water. So you can get them in.
Helpful.
Well, the properties that make them useful also are the ones that sort of might cause problems.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, you can find them in water repellent clothing. You can find them in some makeup. And because of some of the contamination in the environment, they move through, and you can find them in drinking water, and they're in dust. So it's they're all over the place, which is a shame, but it doesn't necessarily mean that we should be panicking about them.
Right. Is there any new research or technologies being developed to assist in the removal of these persistent chemicals?
Yes, there are. Actually, there's quite a lot of, especially in the US, there's a lot of startups that are getting into this area to try and remove PFAS from water and soil. So there's two major approaches. I think in water, they're really trying to just break it down through various techniques. Whereas in soil, in a lot of the cases, they're trying to lock it up. So it's immobilize it. In the US, it's a bit more in the US, because the US EPA recently announced that they were basically they're going to lower the limit to as close to zero as they can get over the next 5 years. So there's now a driver there to try and reduce these levels as far as possible. That's where I think the major input's going to come. But hopefully that technology could then potentially spread. It's quite difficult to do, because you're trying to remove like a teeny tiny amount of something from an awful lot of water. So that can be quite energy intensive.
Yeah, I also wanted to ask about, just in terms of while we're on environmental pollutants, about microplastics. What in your experience is the research saying about health risks relating to microplastics and their presence in the environment?
Well, they're another interesting class that's sort of been found all over the place. The health risks, I would suspect, are mostly low. And in fact, the World Health Organization suggests that there is currently insufficient evidence to indicate they're having a negative health effect. But they do make the point that that's not the same thing as saying they're safe. They're suggesting more information would be useful. Again, they have been found in drinking water. And they've also been found in the air. And I suspect that most of our exposure to microplastics probably comes from air rather than water. The problem is they're very small. So technically a microplastic is classed as anything with a piece of plastic with a diameter of less than 5 millimeters, but most of them are much, much smaller. And in fact, we also get what's termed nanoplastics, which are in the nanometer range. And again, it's very difficult to measure these, particularly as most labs have a lot of plastic in them anyway. The background contamination is pretty tricky. So there are a few papers that came out saying they found microplastics in beer for example, and some of the other scientists were like, well, no, you haven't. That's contamination from the lab. We're pretty sure on that. And there was a report where they reported microplastics in blood, but somebody else pointed out, well, you've got microplastics in your blanks, basically. So it's probably lab contamination rather than, at least a lot of it would be lab contamination. So it's quite difficult to pull out. If you read the literature, there's a lot of variation on the levels being reported in food and drinking water and so forth. So I think we probably need a bit more information. But again, plastics have been around since the 1950s, I think.
Is there a clear way forward with the research to sort of combat the contamination aspect when you're researching microplastics? Because that seems like quite a challenge as well.
It certainly is. So one of the things that's sort of lacking in microplastics research at the moment is concrete or protocols that everybody uses the same way sort of thing. So sometimes people do things different ways and you get sort of a different result. So there's a lot of pressure at the moment to come up with standardized methods for testing microplastics in terms of how you process a sample, how you collect the sample, which method you use to analyze it, etc. I did read an interesting paper recently where University of Queensland built a special lab where they purposely tried to create it to have as little background contamination as possible. So they were using, you know, steel and so forth and not having any plastics in there. And they had it built a extraction system the same way that you might have if you were dealing with pathogenic organisms, yeah, you know, to stop things coming in from outside and escaping. And they found something like, I can't remember the exact figure, but there was either 30 to 300 times reduction in the level of microplastics they were finding in their sample. So it showed it did have an effect. But yeah, Obviously that's probably not feasible for everybody to build a special lab.
Indeed, but I'm sure those standardized protocols would go a long way as well, wouldn't they? And you've just published a conversation article recently talking about environmental pollution and risks involved for human health. You know, in your research and in your view, what to you is the biggest issue for human health in regards to environmental pollution?
I think for me, air pollution is probably the one that we know causes a lot of harm. There's a lot of deaths every year from air pollution. Even here in Australia, it causes issues. But if you go somewhere like, say, India, I went to Hyderabad a few years ago with the university, a sort of exchange trip, and the air pollution there is absolutely phenomenally bad. So that's probably the biggest risk, I think. But people tend to be bad at assessing risk in general. So the more you hear something's a risk, the more you believe it's likely to be a risk, even if it's not. And we weigh up risk inconsistently. So, for example, people will be worried about a tiny amount of PFAS in the water, but they'll go and get, say, Botox, which is botulinum toxin injected into their face, and think that's fine. Or, you know, if you drive your car, you can get an accident and be seriously injured or die. But most of us assume that we'll be fine, and we rate the risk as very low. But in fact, it's probably higher than the likelihood of getting a problem from PFAS.
How can we stay informed, and where can people go for those sort of clear evidence-based research and, you know, to be able to combat some of that human psychology that goes on?
Well, that's a good question, because at the moment, with the advent of sort of social media and particularly TikTok and things like that, information from, so to say, influencers spreads quite quickly, and sometimes those people they're not really qualified to talk about what they just decide to repeat something they found on online, or something they personally believe without the evidence sort of thing in it. But I have noticed there's been a sort of a rise of the scientists on TikTok sort of debunking this sort of thing. So there's somebody called Dr. Andrea Love. She's very good. There's Michelle Wong and Dr. Ids, who does a lot of stuff about food misconceptions, trying to sort of fight back a bit. For some reason, there seems to be a little bit of distrust in scientists at the moment. So if you go on and say, well, I don't think chemical pollution is quite as bad, you can sometimes be called names. You can sometimes be, you know, told, oh, you're working for a big chemical, which I'm not. I mean, but actually, I think the problem is that misinformation on chemical pollution and chemicals in general actually causes harm, because people then start to worry about, you know, increases vaccine hesitancy, for example. Mm. And then you start to see, tragically, people, especially children, have died from preventable diseases because the parents were too scared to get them immunized. And people will say, not eat what's perfectly nutritious food because they've read some scare story about one particular ingredient, which isn't relevant.
On that note, I guess, dear listeners, if you are on TikTok, make sure you're getting a balanced diet of some qualified expert scientists to go along with the other TikTokers out there, I would say.
My message isn't that we shouldn't worry about pollution and we shouldn't be complacent, but we also shouldn't panic, and we should be looking at, you know, evidence-based risk assessment and solutions rather than panicking about the latest trend. And it worries me a bit when we see in the press, we often see these scare stories and they're like, you know, this chemical causes cancer, this chemical causes cancer, X, Y, Z. And I think, A, it causes unnecessary panic, and B, people tend to switch off about it. So it's not actually helpful. It's, you know, clicks and likes and whatnot make money for the influencers, but they don't actually settle the science. So my message is basically just look at who's providing the message and whether they might have a, you know, potential conflict. We should definitely still be vigilant about the environment.
Well, Oliver, thank you for joining us on Lost in Science today. Thank you for sharing your knowledge. And I would definitely recommend anyone to jump on to the conversation and read, Oliver, your excellent article on risk and chemicals and environmental pollutants. But thank you again for your time today.
Oh, thank you very much for having me on the show.
And that is all we have time for this week on Lost in Science. Thank you for joining us in Getting Lost. If you have any questions or suggestions for the team, get in touch with us by email. We are lostinsci@gmail.com. You can send cheap tweets to us at lostinscience1 on Twitter, or you can find us on the ubiquitous Facebook. Lost in Science is recorded at the studios of 3CR in Melbourne on the land of the Kulin Nation and is broadcast across Australia on the Community Radio Network with the assistance of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. You can find a podcast version of the show on 3cr.org.au, or you can tune in the way you did this week when we return in our usual time slot to get
Lost in Science!
Thanks for listening to a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online.